Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Wednesday, April 6, 2022. The time is 1:38 p.m. I apologize for the late start. We are still waiting for one of our committee members to join us by phone, but we'll just go ahead and get this rolling in his absence, and he'll probably join us shortly. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, and myself as Chair, Senator Holland. We do hope Senator Schauer will be able to join us shortly, but we do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Nate, our moderator for today. And as a reminder, if you have your cell phones on board, please silence your cell phones. At this point, I'm going to bring Senate Bill 207 before the committee. It is related to accessing marijuana conviction records. This is the first hearing for 207 in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Schauer, we're still waiting on, but I will invite I will invite Claire Gross to the presenter's table, and if you want to provide us with a brief overview of the sponsor statement and the sectional analysis, when we get Senator Schauer here, we'll actually ask him to say a few words on it as well. But please state your name and your affiliation and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Holland, and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee for hearing this bill. I'm Claire Gross, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins, and we are carrying the companion bill in the House to this. I just was going to give a quick generalized overview, and then we'll go through the sectional, but the main thing that I think of when I try to explain this bill is that there are two different parts to it, and there's the court systems portion of it, and then there's the Department of Public Safety's portion of it. And when we're talking about the court system, we're mostly talking, there's language that says a publicly available website. I'm sure most of you already understand that that means court view that we're talking about for accessing records on the court system side. And then with Department of Public Safety, what we're dealing with are just a specific type of background checks that are the type of background checks most commonly used by you or I, or just somebody who is an employer and wants to.
Nor him.
And if somebody wanted to do a background check on a potential employee, they would do this any person's report. There are a number of other types of background checks, I should say, that have very specific uses, and we're not addressing those. But anyway, so those are the two parts, court system and DPS. And what is happening here is we're kind of trying to address the two main ways that employers and members of the public access criminal justice information.
And with that being said, looks like Senator Schauer is available. So because we don't know how long we're going to have him. So if I could jump to Senator Schauer. And we'll see. Senator Schauer, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Sorry about the background noise. As you know, I'm at the airport.
You're coming through loud and clear. But if you'd care to provide any kind of a sponsor statement overview on Senate Bill 207 regarding marijuana convictions, we'll cover you right now.
Okay, thank you. So the intent of this bill is to basically take off people that are struggling to find jobs. When you look at the rehabilitation side or reentry for folks that might have had a conviction, it is very difficult, as anybody that's gone through that training will tell you, to be able to get your life back on track when an employer won't take you, you can't get security checks and other things. And so there's a little over 700 people with this affects in the state of Alaska since they passed the law to make possession of marijuana, if you're just using it, legal. And I have had to be clear, I did not vote for that law. I wasn't necessarily a fan of it, but it's the law. And so people that previously would have had a conviction on that no longer or today would not have been convicted. And so the attempt here is to try to get us to a point where people that would have that on their record can get back to work. They can get the appropriate jobs. They're not going to be held up because of a conviction that's no longer illegal. And if I was to top level it and not spend too much time on it, that's basically what this does, is to try to get those people back into society as productive members and avoid the struggles they have of getting good productive jobs and being part of the society again. So I don't think I need to spend more time. Claire does a really good job of explaining it, and that's the top level. I will just add one last thing, Mr. Chairman, and that is that when this first was presented to me a few years ago, it had a little bit more ties to it as far as, possibly other convictions or other types of drugs. And The folks that were working on this were very open to making this very specific to just marijuana and just the possession and the change of law. So they helped get us to this point, and I support it in the current form. That's all I've got. Thanks.
All right, I'll just see. I don't know how long we'll have Senator Shar on board. Are there any questions from the committee for the sponsor? Senator Hughes.
If he has time, you know, when you look back and see what the will of Alaskans voters are, it could have been, had this been brought earlier, it might have been passed earlier. We don't know. But I'm struggling, and if you could help me reconcile, it is the law now, so someone possesses marijuana now, it's not going to be on the record. However, at the time, these individuals did break the law. So I understand the purpose of employment, but just help me understand. We're basically saying, you know, it's okay that you broke the law. We're going to pretend like you didn't. And maybe it's not just the particular act of marijuana and what somebody thinks about that, but it's just the principle, I guess, of someone broke the law, and that shows something about a person that, and I'm sure all those people knew it was against the law at the time, and yet they chose to proceed with that behavior. And yes, it is blocking them from employment, but how can we reconcile the fact that they were choosing a behavior that they knew was against the law, and now we're going to kind of look away from that? Just, can you help me with that?
Senator Shower.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So if you want to go back to the 1920s and the speakeasies, we could pretty much say the entire country of our entire country should be, held accountable, because most people drank, and they drank when it was illegal. And after a certain number of years, we repealed that and went back to where alcohol was legal again. And so this is not the first time in our history this has happened, where something was made illegal, people were held accountable, put in jail, et cetera, and then later it was made legal again. And they worked on. Now, you could say that, well, marijuana was never legal by the federal government. That's certainly true. However, there is precedence for this of, as times change and the laws change, allowing people to be able to still live their life and be productive members of society. So I push that out as, first of all, a precedent set that this is not the first time this has happened in our nation at a national level, state level, obviously. But beyond that, it's kind of like, do you have an eternal sentence? So most of these people have, they're very low level as far as, you know, what the prosecution might have been in their punishment. Usually, in a lot of cases, it's minimum or, you know, security time or minimal prison time, if any. And they get community service and other types of things. And do we want to continually punish them for the rest of their life and make it hard for them to get a job? Or do we want these people to be reintegrated and be successful in society, you know, after having so-called served their time? Because what happens with these types of things when it's a low level, offense like this, and there was no violence or other drugs involved or selling drugs or anything like that, you're essentially giving them what could almost be termed a lifelong sentence. And I understand your point. I'm just saying that it's not the first time we've done this, and the best way to get these people back on track and have 700 plus Alaskans with better jobs, you know, happy members of society or productive members of society is a good thing. And this kind of takes us a step in that direction. So you can certainly vote either way, Senator Hughes, for this one, but I just think that from my perspective, I would rather have them be able to get back to work with good jobs and not have a lifelong sentence for something that was at such a low level. And I take your point. I should go either way. But I think this is a positive step. If they had anything else tied to it at all, you know, domestic violence, selling of drugs or anything else, I wouldn't agree to it. It's just this one thing for possession where we changed it. That's it. Hope that helps.
Follow up?
All right.
And that's helpful. Thank you, Senator Shower. And I just want to understand a couple technicalities as far as the bill, if you have time. If not, we can go to the staff here. And that is, if a person has multiple convictions, can this single item be pulled? I know when we've been talking about other items being removed from court view, if they have other things, it can't be. So how does that work? If they have four convictions and that one of them is possession, can that be pulled? And then secondly, we're not actually removing it from their record. We're just not making it public. So could you also tell us what types of background checks would this information, for the typical ones, employers, it would not be available. But there was some suggestion, and I think in your sponsor statement too, that it could still be accessed by some. Perhaps if someone wants to be a trooper or a police officer, are those the kind of situations where they could still access the information?
Yes, the answer to your questions is it is. It's still there. It's not gone. So if you went to like a security clearance level or something else, they could still access it and see it. And I think that's probably the most germane part of your two questions is that we're really not. It's not truly being expunged in the sense of like, you know, they were found not to be guilty of that in the past. It's simply going to be hidden from view so that they won't be prevented from getting certain jobs that they might need. But it still might prevent, for example, if they needed a top secret security clearance. Federal government might still look at that and go, nope, you don't qualify because of XYZ. And so it's not and that's why I said kind of a lifelong sentence. This could still impact them, but for many jobs that they could otherwise get that wouldn't require that level of scrutiny, this would prevent them from having those jobs unless we were able to pass something like this so that it was hidden from view. But it is still there. And I think I skipped your first question, but Claire may have some clarifying because I think the answer to your first question was no, but I'm going to let Claire jump in just to make sure I get it right on the technical.
And the first question was, I believe, can they just stripe certain parts of court view, or if it's four crimes altogether and one of them is a marijuana conviction, they all have to stay up?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Hughes, the answer is, I believe, a very for sure no. They can't do that. That was one of the main things that we had to work with in this bill, and that's why it says in the criteria for these type of very narrow charges that they have to have been convicted of or charged with no other charges, I believe the words are, in the same case. And that has to do with the court view technology and how they're able to delete any cases at all. And they can't go in there and pick them and out of there. So it has to be the only charge. And actually, they're just looking at convictions. So if you did have multiple convictions, that would not be eligible for this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Akil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to the sponsor's answer to Senator Hughes' first question, because I guess I had a slightly different perception about what the state of the law had been in Alaska before the 2014 voter initiative. And I guess I don't know if it's Senator Schauer or Ms. Gross, but the amounts we're talking about in the crimes in question were covered by the Raven decision that said possession and use of marijuana in small amounts is constitutionally protected under Alaska's right to privacy. Am I sort of overstating what that meant to the confusion that Alaskans might have or the state of the law from, you know, roughly the year before I was born until the initiative?
Senator Schauer?
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like Claire to answer that because I go back to the technical side on the actual amounts that Senator Keel is discussing, which is correct. But it steps us into when we made it legal from the class six substance that the feds have. So it might be better to have Claire describe how those two tie together. I think it'd be more appropriate.
Thank you, Senator Shire. I think she's looking for a phone a friend or something like that. So Claire, is there someone you'd like to bring to the presenter's table to give you a hand on this?
Yeah, Chair Holland, I would ask if either Nancy Mead from the Alaska court system or Kelly Howell from the Department of Public Safety
have see which one stands up first.
Anything to add to this. Otherwise, we can look into getting more information about this. I don't know off the top of my head. I think it's a good question.
There's
no.
Was does Casey know?
Or
how about
Casey Schroeder from
Casey Schroeder?
Didn't know that we.
I'm sorry that Ms. Schroeder was the third choice, but. If you have some input, I believe the question is, what was the status of marijuana possession before 2017? And because, 2014. I guess it got 17 out of this. So did you want to repeat your question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you said it right specifically with regard to the amounts that would be covered under this particular 1171060.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Through the chair, Senator Keel, you're correct. Raven said small quantity personal use was permittable, was permitted under the privacy clause. However, they've deferred to the legislature on what small quantity personal use means. And as anyone who has followed this will tell you, that that line has moved several times over the years. And so in 2014, the people said an up to an ounce is the personal use acceptable amount.
What were other amounts? Not being a marijuana user, I wouldn't know. But so we're talking about, I just ballpark, we're talking about much over, or we're talking about actually parts of an ounce?
Mr. Chairman, I know that at times it was over an ounce. There was a case that followed Raven that was called Noy, and I can't remember off the top of my head what that amount was. I apologize, I wasn't here for this bill, so I'm going a little bit cold. But there has been quite a progression since the 70s on what the legislature has decided was the amount. And I think there has been some fighting, basically, between the legislature and the courts about what they think the amounts should be.
All right. Senator Thiel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think our level of clarity is exactly my point.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Senator Schauer, I think, let me look around. Are there any more questions for the sponsor? I see none, and I'll probably be able to tell you safe travels.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it.
All right. So, sorry for the interruption, Ms. Gross. If you care to kind of pick up wherever you think you might have left off, we'll go into any other sponsor statement kind of things you have to say, and then into the sectional analysis.
Sure. Through the chair, Claire Gross, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. I think it sounds like a lot of people here are already pretty familiar with this bill, so maybe I don't need to get super deep into it, but I will just finish my little spiel there, and that is that we are talking about very narrow scope of convictions here that have to be the only, and I just referenced the bill, and it was not convicted of any other criminal charges in that case. However, they are looking at convictions when they're trying to make this decision. They're looking at the ultimate result, essentially. And I just wanted to flag one thing that reasonably so Senator Schauer had mentioned, that there was a figure of some 700 Alaskans that would be helped by this bill. I just want to point out that we have some very widely differing numbers between the Alaska court system and the Department of Public Safety, which you can see in the fiscal note analysis for each of them. And that there are some specific reasons for that, having to do with the way that they store information and how they're able to look back and see exactly what part of the statute that we are referring to here is actually was the offense that was committed. Anyways, I won't try to explain that too much unless people want to know more, in which case I would bring up Nancy Mead from the court system to help with that. But I just wanted to point out that the numbers from DPS are actually more around 8,000 Alaskans, so we've got a pretty big difference there depending on how what we're really doing. So for the background checks, and those are just Alaskans who could benefit from this, who have charges that meet these requirements and are the only charges in a case. And so, widely differing numbers there, but there's a reason for it. And anyway, so I'll just real quick, the first half of this bill, let's say the Alaska court system will automatically be removing these types of convictions from court view. That's important because in all of this, we're talking automatic versus petition. So court, they will do this automatically, and they will do it retroactively. There's a portion at the end of the bill in the prior court record, section 5, that hopefully I'm on the House bill. It's section 5 that says that they will, to the extent practical, be removing these court records before the effective date of this act. And so retroactive and going forward. And then for the DPS side of it, they will be requiring a petition process, which we kind of went through. It became apparent that there wasn't going to be any kind of cost reduction by making it automatic, and just the way that they were planning to review these records, if this bill did pass, they were going to be taking on, the fiscal note reflects this, like one or two temporary positions to go through all of these records. And we've been told that the way they would do it is just start at the beginning, basically, and be working through them all the time while this employee is employed there, And then as people petition, they will take, they'll go to the, essentially the front of the line to get their petition and get their records expunged, or excuse me, not expunged, to get their records shielded. And so it was kind of like there was no difference between them just going through all the records all the time. Anyway, this person is still going to be doing the same amount of work and on the same timeline, essentially. But we wanted to provide the petition process for people who really would benefit from this, because there might be a lot of people out there that have, you know, convictions that meet these requirements, but this isn't keeping them from doing whatever they're doing in their life, or it was such an old charge, or maybe they have so many other charges that this really wouldn't make much of a difference. So we wanted to provide the option for people that really are feeling affected by this and have charges that meet the requirement to petition and not have to wait until all of the cases in Alaska have been gone through to the end. So I hope that made sense. Maybe that was more information than anyone needed on that. But yeah, and so, and one more thing to note is that the court system is, they have their own records, of course, and the Department of Public Safety is pulling from a different database. They're pulling from the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, which is not a publicly accessible database. So you do have to do a little more work to get those background checks. You have to go in physically to a building. I want to say it's not the courthouse, I don't think. It's an official government building, and you need to go in and in person order these background checks. So functionally, we know that most people get this information from CourtView, even potential employers. But we're just trying to get, if somebody does want to do this other way, this would capture a lot of the other, what's left over if they're not using CourtView, I guess. But that just not, like, as has been pointed out, this does not mean that these records are fully sealed. If somebody really wanted to get this information, they could still go into the courthouse and request it. There's kiosks that you physically have to go to the courthouse and use, and that's, it's prohibitive, I think, for a lot of people, but you could still do it. And you could also still request, I believe there's another type of, I don't know that for sure, actually, but I think there is some other type of background checks. Well, and it was mentioned before, people were talking about individuals that need state licensure. There is a long list of people who require, anybody who requires state licensure would not benefit from this bill for the background check portion of it. And then there are, because there are other types of background checks that are not these any person's reports that deal with like children and vulnerable adults, people that work with them. And there's something called a full criminal history report. Although they don't get many requests for this, but it covers overseas travel and immigration requests. And then again, all potential employees requiring state licensure cannot have their criminal history record information shielded. So we actually are, even with this side of it, covering a pretty narrow group of people, and people that maybe need some extra oversight, we're still allowing for that. So there still are avenues to get this information, and not everybody is eligible, I guess, for this record shield. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that jumps out here.
At this point, I'll just see, does anyone in the committee have any questions for Ms. Groth?
I do.
Senator Hughes?
Thank you. You mentioned anyone going for state licensure, and so there are many different kinds of licensure. You just mean professional license, occupational licensing? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, I believe so. And I was, through the chair, Senator Hughes, and I was trying to find my list here. There's a statute that lists them all, which I can get to the committee. It's actually a fairly long list, but it includes anything. I think law enforcement has their own statute that requires that they still have their, that we can't block their background reports, essentially. But people such as massage therapists, for instance, are on this list, and it's a very long state licensure list.
And another short one like that. So you mentioned those working with vulnerable populations, and I know, I think for Medicaid, there has to be some pretty high scrutiny as far as that thing. So the healthcare profession, some of those positions, I'm not sure if they have to be licensed, some of them. So even if someone is going to be a janitor at a nursing home facility or whatever, they have to be able to pass this kind of thing. So for anyone that has to fit that criteria, this information would continue to be available?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that's correct.
And then one clarifying question, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that someone could still walk into the courthouse and get all this information. So even if we pass this, if an employer didn't want to just look on CourtView, they'd be able to walk in and still see that the person had a marijuana possession conviction, even after we pass this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, that's correct. They would be, but they would have to physically go to their town's courthouse and go on these kiosks and get it. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Any other questions from the committee? Have you considered that you have gone through the sectional analysis? Did you have a structured sectional analysis? I know you're kind of hitting it blow by blow, but
got a little away from me. But yeah, we could go through the sectional quickly if you'd like to.
Please do.
Okay. So section one is the legislative intent behind this bill. And I should note the one change that has been made since this bill was introduced in the Senate is in the last committee in Senate State Affairs, they removed half of the legislative intent that was formerly there with the feeling that it was maybe kind of vague and confusing and not necessary, I believe, because it's talking about low-level crimes, these low-level crimes without referring back to marijuana specifically. It was the feeling of the committee that this was pretty much covered by the first half, that we want to reduce barriers to employment for people convicted of low-level marijuana possession crimes. And section two amends subsection B8 of AS 1262-160 by adding criminal justice information for marijuana possession that meet the requirements laid out in F of this section, which is the you must be 21 years of age or older, no other charges in that case, and and it has to be under 1171-060, which is the less than an ounce of a Schedule 6 controlled substance, and adds this to the list of exceptions for the release of criminal justice information. And section 3 adds a new subsection F to AS 1262-160, which adds new criteria for criminal justice information that an agency cannot release. This new section prohibits release of criminal justice information for convictions under AS 1171-060, like we were just talking about. And section 3 is dealing with the Department of Public Safety. So this is the background checks portion of that. And it mentions there at the end that they have to formally request that the agency not release those records. That's the petition. Section 4 adds a new section to AS 22.35 stating that records of criminal charges or convictions that meet the requirements stated in this section may not be published by the court system on a publicly available website. So this is the court system side of that. This applies to criminal justice information for convictions under AS 1171-060. Those same criteria, where the defendant was 21 years or older, not convicted of any other criminal charges in the same case. Section 5 adds a new section to the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, saying that the Alaska court system shall remove court records that meet the requirements of this bill retroactively, going back from the effective date of the bill. It also uses the language to the extent practicable to clarify that the court system will not be legally required to expend excessive resources or funds to ensure every single record that meets the requirements of this bill for removal from court view is removed. And then section 6 provides the effective date of January 1st, 2023.
All right, Ms. Gross, thank you so much. Senator Akil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one sort of practical question or question about the scope of the bill. We're talking about 1171-060, possessing less than an ounce. There are things a person can do with cannabis under 050 that are legal today, that depending on the circumstance were covered by the court decisions of the past, but you don't put those in the bill. I'm talking about giving someone without remuneration, giving someone some less than an ounce of cannabis or manufacturing it into something, right, making the brownies of so many jokes in your home. Well, is there a reason that you elected not to include those things in this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. Yeah, that's a great question. And this was flagged by your staff for me yesterday, and I was looking into it a little bit more. I am not finding for sure, and maybe this might be another question for Casey Schroeder with the Department of Law, but I don't see definitively that because what they're talking about in 1171.050 is this person committing a crime involving misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fifth degree if the person manufactures or delivers or possesses with the intent to manufacture or deliver one or more preparations, compounds, mixtures, substances less than an ounce, aggregate weight less than an ounce of a Schedule 6 controlled substance, which is only marijuana. So when I look at the personal use of marijuana in 1738.020, which is kind of what we look to see what has been made not a crime anymore, right? So it's it says, notwithstanding any other provision of law except as otherwise provided in this chapter, the following acts by a person 21 years of age or older are lawful and are not criminal or civil offenses under state law or the law of any political subdivision of the state law. And it goes on, and there is nothing here that I can find that refers to the manufacturers or delivers. Right away, in number one after that, we see the type of convictions we're dealing with in 1171.060. It says it's legal to possess, use, display, purchase, or transport marijuana accessories or 1 ounce or less of marijuana. They don't get into the manufacturers or delivers. And I don't know for sure. I need to look more into that to understand the nuances between, is this because they're not a licensed marijuana establishment? And then there are statutes that control that on its own. But we didn't see that as something that had been definitively made legal, so to say. And when we're getting into manufacturing or delivering, that starts to seem like a little bit more of a, maybe a more an extreme offense, I guess. So I'm still trying to find out definitively that it is legal, what is in 050, and can get back to you about that. But it was my understanding that that was not made legal yet, for sure, and that it was also more than just this idea of somebody having less than an ounce of marijuana on their person, the simple possession. But that's certainly something we could look into further if it's just an oversight.
Okay. We'll have plenty of time. We're not going to be saying amendment deadline. We'll be having this in follow-up meetings as well. Senator Hughes?
Yes, I'm just trying to understand Section 3 and 4, both of the number 2s. It pertains to people 21 years of age or older at the time of commission of the offense. So what's the deal with 18, 19, and 20-year-olds?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yeah, we I don't know if I can get into this, but we have been addressing that in the other body with HB 246. There was kind of some feeling that we need to be, there's people who are not minors, but who are also not over 21, but they're adults, and they're still feeling the effects of these charges. One thing to note is between 18, 19, and 20, that is a Class B misdemeanor if you are to be charged with that, unlike it being legal for somebody over 21. There we have, with the other, with HB 246, we have amended it at this point to include 18, 19, and 20-year-olds and reduce that misdemeanor down to a violation with no court appearance. So, and then also have those records removed from court view. We have not.
I guess I'm confused. Right now, marijuana is only legal for 21 and older. It's not for 18. Oh, I didn't know that.
Similar to
like alcohol,
I guess. I did not realize that myself.
Yeah.
Okay. It's making more sense.
All right. With no more questions from the committee for Ms. Gross, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. We do have available for questions. I'll go look to Nancy Mead. Nancy Mead, do you have any comments to make on this bill? No? Okay.
I actually do, just on the age thing.
For Ms. Mead?
No, for the staff here. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Getting your name. Your name is Claire.
Claire Gross.
So back in the day, before we passed the initiative, if someone were 18, 19, and 20 who possessed, was that a crime then? Was it the same crime that it was for somebody that was 21?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I am not actually sure on that. Maybe I could ask a lifeline.
Yeah, it might be. We'll bring up, see if Ms. Schroeder or Ms. Howell has, or Ms. looks like, Ms. Schroeder, there you go. It's just like to tell the truth to see who's going to be the one telling the truth stands up. So if you could provide some insight to that question, then probably while we have you here, if Department of Law has any thoughts on this bill.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, through the chair, Senator Hughes, before the initiative, it was also a Class B misdemeanor. So it's the same. There's been no change for people under the age of 21.
And follow up, because now all these people are adults, right? So now we're talking about, okay, we're going to let one group of adults, it's not going to show up on your court record. For another group of adults, it is. So, you know, I don't know if we have an equal protection issue there. And just wondering whether we should, and something for the committee just to consider, whether we should have 18, 19, 20-year-olds. Because if they were under 18, it wouldn't be showing up, right? As a minor, it wouldn't be. So now we've got a certain group of adults that would still, it would show and not for others. That's just a consideration. And then I think you wanted to know what the Department of Law's thoughts were about the bill in general.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just respond to Senator Hughes, the difference is that under current law, it's still a crime for people under the age of 21. So that would be the distinction there. And it looks like Senator Keel may want to.
Senator Keel, do you want to jump in?
On that specific point, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Schroeder, have there been any challenges under Raven or Noy to the current state of the law enacted by initiative that does keep it a crime for 18, 19, 20-year-olds?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
All right.
And Mr. Chairman, this bill actually does not impact the criminal division, so that's why I was hanging out back there, not jumping up.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. I'm sure we'll bring you up to look at the state historical artifacts. I have Kelly Howell in the thing. Ms. Howell, do you have any comment on DPS? Any comment on this Senate Bill 207.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I'm the Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. The department is supportive of the changes proposed in this legislation, and we do have Ms. Lisa Perrington online. She oversees the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, which this bill touches on in terms of the criminal history background checks that come from the Department of Public Safety. So she's also available for questions, as am I, if the committee has any.
All right. Thank you. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So either for Ms. Howell or for Ms. Perrington, whichever is appropriate. So you guys will do background checks on request for a number of things, employment, housing. This is done on a case-by-case basis. We're not talking about court view where everybody can see it. We're talking about specific individual requests, correct?
Senator Myers, through the chairs, that's correct.
So when you do one of these requests, I imagine that there's probably other personal information that you already have to scrub, whether somebody's social security number is attached or something along those lines. So you already have to take the record that you pull off of your computer system and scrub it a little bit before you can hand it out. Is that correct?
Senator Myers, through the chair, excuse me. The reports that come out are already formatted and ready to go in terms of when someone requests that report. So there's no additional scrubbing, if you will, that needs to occur. They're already ready to be formatted in a manner that removes that information.
Okay, thank you. Right. And then one other along those lines.
Excuse me.
Since this is done on a case-by-case basis, I'm trying to figure out why you've got a fiscal note that wants a person to start looking at your records for a couple of years. I could actually kind of understand that a little bit more coming from the court system, because they've got their entire court system to go through and scrub. but you're doing it on a case-by-case basis. Why don't you just have somebody pull that one piece of information out on a case-by-case basis as it's requested?
Senator Myers, through the chair, again, Kelly Howell for the record. That is certainly possible. The department is making an assumption that we don't know how many individuals will come forward to request this. And as Ms. Mead and Ms. Gross, or excuse me, Ms. Gross, it wasn't Ms. Mead, referred to the court system records and the records that the Department of Public Safety have diverged pretty significantly in terms of the numbers. So there are up to 8,500 criminal history records that the department has identified that could be impacted by this bill. Not knowing how many individuals may come forward to request that this information be shielded from release, the department is suggesting that if we hire a temporary position to start going through these records and doing that research, because it won't unfortunately be simple to identify someone's criminal conviction as being applicable under this bill. There would be some research that would need to be done. Again, as Ms. Gross stated, there have been numerous changes to the law, and whether or not someone's conviction under 1171-060 was for less than 1 ounce of marijuana would need to be researched. And so the department would prefer to take proactive measures to start examining those records, identify those that would potentially qualify, and flag those so that if that individual does come in to have that information and request that information be shielded, it will be a much quicker process for that individual rather than having to wait for a period of time for us to do that research. But to get back to your original question, the department could do this on request, but it may create a backlog depending upon the number of individuals that come forward.
All right.
A bit of a follow-up. Just a comment. Had a bill of my own not too long ago that I would got to be a little bit of a victim of an interesting fiscal note, and this is striking me in the same way. I'm having a hard time believing that you need a person just to go through 8,500 records for a couple of years to take care of this. It seems to me as things are pulled on a case-by-case basis, it would be much simpler in the long run to simply update them as those particular individuals came up. And because in particular we're not talking about new cases being generated, we're talking about cases that had been generated prior to 2014. As you went along, you'd have fewer and fewer of those left in the system, and it concerns me a little bit on the fiscal note. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Correction, Senator Myers. Looked at him, saw somebody else. At this point, I have no more questions. Looks like no more questions from the committee. We can go to, we're actually waiting for Senator Sharp for the next bill. So I'll just check with Lisa Purrington, Department of Public Safety. I know you referenced her. I just see. Ms. Purrington, do you have any further comments on Senate Bill 207?
For the record, Lisa Purrington with Alaska Department of Public Safety. Thank you for the question, Chair. Just to further support what Ms. Howe had provided regarding the fiscal note and the person to do the research, with the 8,500 records we're looking at, prior to 2000, 2001, the state's criminal history repository did not have statutes listed in the repository. It was just an offense code, which is a four-digit numeric code that would reference that criminal history. So those are going to take quite a bit of research to look into those, and this was just to be proactive to try and speed up the process for those individuals that may come in and request to have these sealed, because we're not sure how long that research would take, because it doesn't actually even have a statute, so it would take a little bit more work to look at. And as Ms. Howe mentioned, the variations on the statutes and how the law has changed, sometimes it did not specify under an ounce. A different amount that it could be under an ounce when you look at the actual police reports or the other supporting documentation on that case.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Purrington. At this point, with no further questions from the committee, I'm going to set Senate Bill 207 aside. Thank you, Ms. Howell. Thank you, Ms. Gross. And I will bring Senate Bill 229 before the committee. Senate Bill 229 is related to state historical artifacts. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 207. It's a governor's bill. Department of Natural Resources will be introducing it to us shortly, but first we have a committee substitute for this bill at the request of the sponsor. Senator Hughes, would you care to make a motion?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the proposed committee substitute for SB 229, Work Order 32-GS2541/I as our working document.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I will object for discussion, and I'll ask Mr. King to come to the presenter's table and discuss the changes to Senate Bill 229.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, staff to Senator Holland. Mr. Chairman, after discussions with the administration, this CS that's before you was drafted based on those recommendations. The change, the significant change is that sections 1-7 of the bill have been deleted. Section AS 4135-200A and B were amended to add a mental state, and that is something that the administration will talk about that is still under needs further work. Change number three is adding a new crime of obtaining confidential information to commit or aid in a crime under this chapter. That was previously in section one, and again, that is an issue that the administration has identified as needing further work. Change number four, the crime of possess, sell, buy, or transport has been elevated to a Class C felony. The other language that was previously in the bill was deleted. And Mr. Chairman, the last change is in the definitions. The definition of artifact was updated to be a little bit more clear.
All right. Thank you, Mr. King. Senator Hughes?
Do we have a document with those, a summary of the changes?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Hughes. I'll get you that document right now.
Thank you.
All right, so take a brief moment to, all right. Is there any discussion on this committee substitute? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection? Without further objection, version I is our working document. And it looks like we have Laura Boomershine joining us via Teams. And I see both you and Judy Bittner on board. I believe you were going to walk us through an overview of the bill, Laura Boomershine. And if so, please state your name, your affiliation, your location, put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Laura Boomershine, the legislative
liaison. One moment. We're going to work on the sound. I think we'll have to turn you up, and maybe if you could bring your mic in a little closer. We'll see what happens. I'm having a hard time hearing you. All right, let's try that again. Place yourself on the record.
Better.
Go ahead and start. We'll see.
Sounds good. For the record, my name is Laura Boomershack. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Natural Resources. Before you today, we have SB 229. On the line today, I have Judy Bittner. She is the chief of the Office of History and Archaeology. She will walk you through this bill this afternoon, as well as any questions that you may have.
All right. Thank you. So I was having a little difficult hearing you. Did you say Ms. Bittner is going to pick up?
That's correct.
All right. Thanks so much. Ms. Bittner, if you please place yourself on the record, we'll see. Maybe we have better luck with your sound system. Once again, state your name, affiliation, and your location. Put yourself on the record, and please begin.
You're on mute.
Oh, I'm sorry. I believe you might be muted.
Okay.
There you go. Name, affiliation, and location, and begin.
Okay. For the record, my name is Judy Bittner. I am the chief of the Office of History and Archaeology, Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, Department of Natural Resources, with offices in Anchorage. The Office of History and Archaeology provides statewide historic preservation programs to identify, document, study, evaluate, protect, restore, and exhibit prehistoric, archaeological, and historic sites and buildings. The office works under state and federal authorities, the Alaska Historic Preservation Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. And the bill before you is amends the Alaska Historic Preservation Act, and the purpose of which is to enhance protections for artifacts and prehistoric, historic, archaeological sites through increased criminal penalties for violations of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. And I think some of the amendments are kind of technical with the Department of Law, and I don't know if you would like the Department of Law to address some of those changes, since they involve the mental state of the individual as in the prosecution. I could try answering those questions, but it does increase the penalties to add a Class C felony with other violations remaining at the misdemeanor level A.
All right. Thank you. Judy Bittner. And at this point, I'll see if Casey Schroeder. I'm sorry. A question from Senator Keel.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we might just take a half step back and ask Ms. Bittner to just talk with us about the problem we're trying to solve. Just broad strokes. What's going on that needs a bill?
Sounds like an excellent idea. Ms. Bittner, did you hear the question?
Through the chair to Senator Keel. Yes, the there's concern about the vandalism and the looting of archaeological sites and the selling of artifacts, the transport and selling of artifacts. And it really came from some constituents that are concerned about that, as well as to trying to have a more of a deterrent for the kind of the trafficking of archaeological site artifacts and historic sites as well. With a misdemeanor, it is difficult to get the troopers and others, you know, to have the time to enforce a misdemeanor offense. And some of the, also with a Class C felony, there's some very high value artifacts, historic artifacts, as well as archaeological artifacts that can be trafficked. And thought that this would be a deterrent.
All right. Follow up, Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bittner, thank you. That's helpful. Does your office have a general sense? Are these situations where people are opportunistically grabbing things they find, or are we seeing organized groups that plan and execute the looting of historical sites? What's the nature of the problem we're seeing?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, we see all of that. You know, there's some, you know, just occasional picking up an artifact if they're hiking or, you know, beachcombing or something, and that's really not what we're concerned about so much. But there are some systematic looting and digging of archaeological sites. Also, with historic sites, people take out metal detectors. They often film themselves, and you can see films on YouTube of them, you know, digging up historic sites and then selling them on eBay or some other place or trafficking with them. And so we're really looking at the systematic destruction of sites and the selling of it in a bigger way. Also, there is a problem on the kind of remote sites as well. I've been to and visited sites where where house pits are systematically dug, and the eroding banks as well, and they have screens in which they're sifting through the soil looking for the artifacts of which then they sell. And so it's really the ones that are doing the most destruction of our heritage sites and selling it in a larger way. And that's why I'm kind of looking at that. Plus, there are some historic World War II plane crash sites, which are part of our World War II National Historic Landmark. And there are folks that go and remove the airplane and the airplane parts. And those are quite valuable for those who are restoring historic aircraft as well. So this is really targeting the systematic larger offenders. And we often work with federal agencies, because the individuals are often working on state land and federal land. And so we often cooperate with the federal law enforcement folks to try to stop this.
All right. Thank you. Chief Bittner, Senator Hughes.
Thank you. Interesting subject. We learned so much in this position. And one of the things I'm wondering about, we've been talking about historic sites and archaeological sites, but would this bill also apply if somebody walked into a museum and took out an artifact? And that would that this be a higher penalty for them if because of this bill? Or would it be higher under current law just for stealing something out of a museum?
Through the chair, to Senator Hughes, our authorities and projects do not cover museums, and so that would be probably a theft, just property theft if somebody stole something from a museum. What we're dealing with are sites that are in place intact in the ground, or historic sites or buildings on state lands. And so the Alaska Historic Preservation Act has a provision in there for permits, and to remove items from a historic site, you need a permit. And so one of the violations is removing these without permission from the state. For investigation, for mitigation of projects, sites are excavated, or historic buildings may be recorded or removed because they're in the way of a project. But that work is taken place under permit and permission. And there are then stipulations as to where those items that are recovered and the information is recovered, where that will, it is directed to send them to either the State Museum or the University of Alaska Fairbanks Museum of the North for long-term curation.
Thank you. And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Just to give us some scope and context of what we're talking about as follow-up to Senator Keel's, why is this bill before us? Do you have any, even a rough estimate of how often someone is taking someone from a site, let's say in a year, and what the value of that we maybe have lost because we haven't had tougher penalties?
No, I don't. it's done frequently. It is not prosecuted very often. But we find evidence of it, and often we will work with the federal agencies, who often then pursue it as a federal case instead of a state case. Early on, let's say in this position, we have confiscated. We haven't taken it to crime, but I've had confiscated from someone that items from folks that have taken things without a permit. Some World War II historic plane parts that we got the troopers to confiscate at the airport with somebody with transporting them out of the state, and another person that had a permission to do a survey on Fort Glenn, but not collect anything, and they collected a gun from a World War II site, and so we were able to track that down. And in those cases, we just took the artifacts back that they collected without permit, but did not prosecute it further. But the Department of Law might know some more about the actual cases that have gone forward.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. At this point, I will ask, I'm sorry, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little bit concerned about the definition of artifact that we have in the bill. It's a very broad definition. Artifact means an object made or crafted by humans. I'm just thinking about some certain properties in the Fairbanks area that I've seen. It's entirely possible that somebody could have the remains of a 1970 Buick on their property. And under the definition of artifact used in the fiscal note, all it says is anything over 50 years old. And if it's an object made over 50 years ago, all of a sudden that Buick goes from an eyesore and something that could get you a violation on your property to a historical artifact. Do we need to specify a little bit more of what the definition of artifact should mean?
That may be a question for Ms. Bittner, or it may be a question for Casey Schroeder. Ms. Bittner, do you have anything to offer on that?
Yes, to the chair, to the senator. It is the this bill is dealing with what is on state land, and kind of the artifact goes through an evaluation of what is historically significant. And what an artifact is very broad. It is, crafted by humans, but what you do with it and whether it's historically significant or something of value for to place under as a kind of historic artifact to be managed in that way, you would go through an evaluation process. And if the Buick, the old car, depended on its historic context, but if it's just an old car, just because it's old doesn't mean it's historically significant. And so you have a broad definition, and then you go through the step of evaluation and analysis to see if it's historically significant to the state and if the state is interested in managing it that way. So I think that there needs to be a broad definition, and then the next step in deciding whether it is historically significant to the state is the evaluation process.
Senator Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment on that. I can understand the point where you have to determine every piece's historic value and decide whether or not it matters, whether or not it's an artifact. But I'd feel a little bit more comfortable if we said that in statute, that it's an object made by humans that, for example, has been determined by the federal government or by DNR to be historically relevant, something along those lines.
Sounds like an excellent amendment. Senator Hughes.
Yes, and also there's nothing in the definition of talking about 50 years or older. That's in the fiscal note. I don't know if that was in a previous version, but do you feel like the 50 years is that kind of a standard number of decades for in your line of work for something that is an artifact that has historical significance?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, no, I do not think it should have a 50-year date for something that's on state lands, because you could have something that's very significant that of recent history. It would remove from consideration items and artifacts that have historic significance to the state in less than 50 years.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. At this time, with a brief at ease. Sorry, back on the record. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. And I believe, Ms. Boomershine, did you have a comment?
Yes, through the chair. I just wanted to mention on a fiscal note, that was to the original draft, and it doesn't reflect the committee substitute that the committee had took up today. So it is a little bit old in the information, and that's why there's a difference between the 50 years and the language that you see before you today.
All right. Thank you so much. Ms. Schroeder, would you please come to the presenter's table? And does Department of Law have any, first of all, if you have any answers for anything you might have heard, and then if you can provide any comment from Department of Law on the committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. In response to Senator Myers's questions about the definition of artifact, the definition of artifact has to be read in conjunction with the definition of historic, prehistoric, and archaeological resources. And there is a definition under law for that, and that's found in 41.35.230. And it says that historic, prehistoric, and archaeological resources includes deposits, structures, ruins, sites, buildings, graves, artifacts, fossils, or other objects of antiquity which provide information pertaining to the historical or prehistorical culture of the people in the state, as well as to the natural history of the state. So that is the limiting language for the broad definition of artifact.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. Does Department of Law have a position on this committee substitute?
Mr. Chairman, I think as your staff has mentioned that the Department of Law believes that the committee substitute needs further work. I think the concepts are included in the CS, but we would probably request some further work on the CS.
All right. As Senator Hughes.
Well, we have you, and it was clarification that this pertains to state lands and the sites mentioned and removing artifacts from that. But if an artifact were in a museum, is there any greater penalty for that than there would be for, stealing something that's not an artifact?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I agree with Ms. Bittner. We would default to Title 11, the criminal code, in that situation. And if somebody broke into a museum, that would be a burglary. And then if they took anything, if we could value it, then we would likely charge theft based on the valuation of the item. So it could be a B felony depending on how valuable the item is. I think the point with this bill, though, is that some of these things, it's difficult to arrive at a monetary value for some of these things. So I think that's the point of this bill.
And follow up,
Senator.
Yeah, and it's hard to put monetary value on something. And that's why I'm just wondering, something that might, a historical item that might auction for $500 worth something else that's $500, is that item actually, because it's of historical significance, should there be a greater penalty? And I don't know if that's a problem if we have people breaking into museums, but I think especially if it's not able to be brought back, gotten back and put in the museum, there's a loss there. And it's separate from this bill, but we don't want those. But that's part of who we are, and to teach the next generation. So I'm just wondering whether there'd be consideration for increased penalties for artifacts stolen from other locations in addition to state lands, and that may not fit with this bill. But I'd be curious if the administration would have a position on that and would ever see the need for that, and that could be something that you could let me know later, but you can't go back and recreate these items if they're destroyed or lost or damaged.
Right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Schroeder, I'm having a little bit of trouble with the underlying notion that was described, that we're having trouble getting relatively good cases prosecuted because of their level, the level of the offense. That sounds like it needs a budget increment, not a bill. That's a comment, not a question. But I'm gonna put it out there. I do have a couple questions on the bill text. I know there are a couple things that you are still working on, but one that I'm not clear on in page one of the bill, it's section three, and it adds language about obtaining information classified as confidential by law. I think we have another statute on that, but is there anything in the Historic Preservation Act or other laws that govern the Historic Preservation Office that that allows them to designate information as confidential? What's the process there?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'm going to defer to Ms. Bittner on the confidential issue.
Ms. Bittner, did you hear the question?
I did hear the question on the confidential data. Through the chair to Senator Keel, we maintain an inventory of historic and archaeological places, the Alaska Historic Resources, and this is it is restricted data, and we've been talking with the Department of Law and looking at the management of that data, and I think that confidential data, it is kind of restricted to the public. It is not. We can hold it back from some of the locational information from public information requests. I think that the office can manage this data without this provision. And so this is a section where we have been talking with the Department of Law as to whether we need the Department of Natural Resources really needs this section, making it a crime to use this confidential information. We do not have a statute in the Alaska Historic Preservation Act right now that defines confidential information in regard to historic items. And so this is actually one of the discussion items for the committee substitute, is whether this section is actually needed.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bittner. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Schroeder. Section 2 of the bill, we are switching our reference to federal statute from 16 U.S.C. 4433 to 18 U.S.C. 1866B, and I'm curious about why we're doing that and some of the significance there.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, my understanding is that the reference that is currently there is something that's been repealed or something by the feds, and so this is just an updated reference, and it was recommended by Ledge Legal.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Myers. With no other questions from the committee, thank you, Ms. Schroeder. My office will address the amendments discussed by the Department of Law on the committee substitute, and we'll circulate committee substitute as it comes available. There's going to be a tentative deadline for additional amendments to my office by Monday, April 11th at noon. And that being said, at this point, I'll set Senate Bill 229 aside. Is there any other business before the committee today? Seeing none, our next meeting is Friday, April 8th at 1:30 p.m., and we will be adjourned at 2:52 p.m.